My tongue speaks so they will know, giving voice to the legacy that has come before. Sojourner, Ida, Dorothy, Mary, Ella, Maya Angelou, others left out of history books, many refusing to, denying my humanity, but I stand and demand. From birthing of a civilization to nurturing a nation, we've been right here. Our breasts, the comfort of men and suckling babies. How dare they not see me? Strength, genius, and beauty. I give voice to this beautiful struggle to shine and bring forth the light, staking claim to our birthright and inheritance of this earth, an overflow of compassion and justice. Using my voice to tell the children, telling the stories of black excellence, Africans, speaking truth to power, if only for 1 hour, they will stop and know that. My tongue speaks so they will know that. Ain't I a woman?
This is Voices of Advocacy Radio with your host, Lakeisha Gray Sewell, showcasing leading activists, community servants, and entrepreneurs. You are now tuned in to truth, community passion, and amplified legacy. Can you hear it? It's Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Thank you all so much for joining us for another edition of Voices of Advocacy Radio. We have with us Niambi Jaha Eccles, who is an author, visionary, social entrepreneur, community activist, training facilitator, visual artist, philanthropist, spiritual alchemist. I love that. Inspirational speaker, self-publishing midwife. I love that as well. And she is also a soul work consultant. Just a powerful, powerful sister. She is the creator of Project Butterfly. And her first book actually was Project Butterfly, Supporting Young Women and Girls of African Descent Through the Transitions of Life. She's currently now overseeing and the founder and visionary for Project Butterfly, New Orleans, and Camp Butterfly, which is like a national movement for the Butterfly Movement. Currently, you're residing in North Carolina, so you're nice and warm.
Yes, yes, absolutely. I mean, it's still a little chilly here, but it's enough. I cannot complain. I surely cannot complain. And I just wanted to do a clarification kind of shout out. The Project Butterfly in New Orleans, the NOLO chapter, is actually run by a beautiful sister, Dr. Rashida Govan. And she actually spearheaded that, and they were inspired by Project Butterfly, and I support them 100%. She's actually working on the curriculum that we'll use as a national piece to, to mirror what they're doing in New Orleans. So it's really exciting, and that'll be launched during the spring when we launch the Butterfly Movement. So I'm really excited about that.
Thank you for that clarification, and we'll definitely have to get her in and on the air with us to talk as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so you're doing all of that, all of those things I mentioned, but you have just released your latest or second book, and that is Inspiring the Souls of Our Girls, 10 Ways to Effectively Support Teenage Girls.
Yes, and I'm really excited about this one because for a number of reasons. One of the reasons is, when I wrote Project Butterfly, my aspiration was for it to absolutely go into the hands of girls. I saw that there was just like a void of information that our girls were getting, and that is what inspired the program Project Butterfly and then later Camp Butterfly. And in working with a lot of women, we've had over 100, almost 200 women to volunteer for Camp Butterfly from across the country and literally from across the world. The first camp that we did, in fact, we had a sister to come and volunteer from Belize. So we've had a lot of women to show up and want to support girls. And one of the things that came out of that is that a lot of these women showed up wanting to support girls, but it was really their own little girls that were needing support, that the call to actually volunteer was their own inner child wanting and needing those things that they didn't get when they were younger. So it became a really interesting mix, and I learned a lot from that experience. And even from the beginning, we put a lot of emphasis on training. But still, there was there's kind of this misnomer that women think that, you know, they've got to save these girls, when in actuality, you can't save a girl unless you are, you know, in a position yourself. So, in other words, we had a lot of Caterpillar women showing up trying to support Butterfly Girls, and it could be very, very challenging coming at it from that aspect. So after, you know, being in the field for so long and working with women who desire to work with girls, and it wasn't just for the women, but, you know, doing training with teachers and social workers and other just child advocates across the country, just realizing that there needs to be more information out there to support that. And so Inspiring the Souls of Our Girls was written to actually go into the hands of those girl advocates who want to support girls. And it gives a different aspect of supporting girls, because basically I'm taking it from a standpoint of the way you help girls is to help yourself.
And you actually have a chapter that's devoted to that, chapter 9, I Want to Work with Girls. And you put a quote in here, don't go to the soup kitchen to serve because you're hungry.
That is
extremely powerful. You said it's challenging if women show up in their caterpillar selves trying to facilitate a butterfly transition. But not only is it challenging, in the book, you kind of give some examples of ways that it can also be traumatic for the girls and the woman who's seeking that.
Absolutely. I mean, it's when you show up, you're either showing up in your power or your pain. And, you know, there's a well-known saying, you know, that's circulated within our community and the world, hurt people hurt people. And that's the truth. That if you don't really deal with the things that are preventing you from being all that you want to be, then they show up. And so it's just like for women, you know, I've seen women who try to facilitate a provocative subject with girls, like looking for daddy love. Well, you can't really facilitate that if you're looking for daddy love yourself. So it's healing our wounds so that we can show up in our fullness and in our highest self, so that we can then support girls. Because every woman that shows up, there is a desire to really want to help our girls. But the underpinning of that desire, if it's motivated out of pain, it's really about that woman getting her needs met. You know, because I've heard a lot of women say, for instance, you know, I want to volunteer because I didn't have anything like this when I was growing up. And, you know, and that sounds very, you know, altruistic. It sounds great, but you can't give what you don't have. So you've got to address those wounds of what happened. You know, you didn't have that. So how did it affect you? And how did you compensate for that? Who were you missing? You know, what were you missing? And so fill that up first, and then out of that abundance, then you can serve. So it's a different take on supporting our girls, because it takes a look at the woman or the person first, and then out of that, then you can serve. And just like the quote, you know, don't go to the soup kitchen to serve and, you know, want to help and you eating all the food because you're starving.
Yeah, and so, you know, I love this book because you give so many different examples of, you know, just to illustrate what the chapter is about. And in this regard, as I said, so much trauma can come out of, because there are a lot of triggers that we have. Mm-hmm. And if we haven't done the work, you know, spiritual work to healing, I love how you say I'm a soul work consultant. Mm-hmm. If people haven't done their soul work, then they have all type of empty and raw wounds that can be triggered and it's not healed. You don't even know what you're dealing with yourself until you come into a room with girls and all your stuff starts flying back at you, and then you're a big open open wheezing wound, and it just gets very ugly. I love he talked about the cousin Margo who mm-hmm. grew up in a session. You want to talk about that?
Yeah, well, we had a really interesting opportunity to demonstrate that, or to have that demonstrated during a session at camp. And during camp, we were all the whole community, the camp community of us, were sitting in a circle. And there was this one young woman who volunteered with us that year. And she was in her 30s, was kind of I think her career was a librarian. And so she had never really worked with girls. She had never she didn't have any children. And so she, that was her desire, that she wanted to work with girls. She grew up in a family of, I think, three or four siblings, and she was the oldest. In the book, I call her Auntie Wanda to protect the guilty and the innocent. So I've changed some of the names, but Auntie Wanda showed up to volunteer. And what happened was she wanted to work with the 12 and 13-year-olds, and that was great. We loved that. But part of the issue was that when she was that age, she had a tormentor in her seventh grade class, this little girl called Gina. And what happened was, because Wanda was not part of the inside group, she kind of craved that. And this seventh grader was always tormenting her. And so, in every class, there's always somebody that's in the know, or at least at that time it was. And so she influenced all the other girls. So if, she wasn't your friend, then none of her friends were your friend. Uh-huh. And so Wanda always found herself on the outside of that. And so years passed. She became an adult. She showed up to volunteer, because she had never gone to camp and wanted to have that experience, and was really, really wanting to work with the 11 and 12-year-olds and that age group. So back to the original, we were sitting in a circle, and Margo was, this vibrant, I think, 12-year-old. She was just very outgoing, very outspoken, just beautiful light spirit that just, everybody liked her, So it was one of those, she'd come in the room and do something silly or funny and everybody would laugh. Everybody, that is, except for Auntie Wanda. She just, there was something about that girl that she just said she just could not stand. She didn't want to have anything to do with her. She didn't think anything she did was funny. Rubbed her the wrong way, completely. And so we were sitting in circle, and, Margo, being who she is, just wasn't paying attention. How teenagers do. They go in and out sometimes, and sometimes can be very self-absorbed. So she wasn't paying attention when another girl was actually sharing something, and this little girl happened to be somebody that Auntie Wanda was fond of. It might have been somebody that even reminded her of herself. And out of nowhere, she got up during the middle of the circle and beckoned for Margo to come outside with her, and anger written all over her face. And so she took her outside, and I didn't know what was happening, and I didn't know what was going to happen when I went outside, because I knew she didn't care for her. So I went out and followed them. And when I went out there, she had her, was just berating her, talking about how selfish she was and that she would have spent her home and just, and the poor girl is looking down on the ground and crying. And so I immediately grabbed her hand, the girl's hand, and that just made Wanda even more angry. And so thankfully, another one of the aunties came out and was able to take Margo and console her, and I dealt specifically with Wanda. And she was angry at me at first for, my first gut response was to not back her up, but to console this child. And so that made her even more furious. And so after a minute, she calmed down and, got back to herself, and we took a walk. And the long and short of it was that she realized that it had nothing to do, nothing at all to do with Margo. What it triggered for her was a little girl, Gina, that when she was in the seventh grade, tormented her. And they just happened to have the same personality. And so the little girl that she was trying to defend was not the little girl in the present, but her little girl from the past. And if she had just had that awareness, it would have probably created a whole different dynamic, and it wouldn't have created this big blow up and all of that. But it just proved a point, and I've seen it happen so many times, that when you don't know what's inside of you, if you don't know those things, and we all have things that have happened to us, if we don't recognize that, then it comes up, you know, somewhere else. You know, because as women, particularly as women, we have been taught to, you know, put on our, you know, superwoman cape. You know, there's sayings all the time that are reinforcing that. Girl, put your big girl panties on and deal with it. You know, ain't nobody got time for that. You know, you all in your feelings. Mm-hmm. So it just reinforces for us that we should, you know, what we feel, what we experience is not important. So just, you know, stuff it down, say you okay when you're not really okay. And you learn that as a, you know, our parents or other women model that for us when we're little girls. And so then we're just girls that have aged out. And as we get older, we learn that behavior and it becomes just second nature that we don't tell the truth when we're not, you know, so when somebody asks you, are you okay? I'm fine. And you can have a headache and, you know, all kinds of things going on.
Heartache, yeah.
Right, heartache, all of that. And so we just stuff it and stuff it and stuff it. And, you know, it's almost like, you know, when you stuff and stuff and stuff, and it's that last little thing, that straw that breaks the camel's back, just it could be the littlest thing that kind of triggers that. Then all of this other stuff comes out. So you have a heavier emotion or a deeper emotion than what the situation warrants. You know, you explode over something really little, or you have more heat around it. I've seen women, for another example, are sitting in a circle with girls and talking about relationships. But if they're in toxic relationships, it goes into the little litany of all men are dogs, and, you know, you got to, mm-hmm. you know, and that's not truth, but it's the truth from your pain and not from your power. And so it's not really supporting the girl in her particular circumstance, it then becomes about you. So rather, if it's going to always be about you, why not deal with it in a proactive way? And so that's what the book is about, is really about us dealing with it in a proactive way of helping to support women to be their highest self so that they can then show up in the world and support girls the way that they need. And our girls don't need us to tell them what to do, but to inspire them. And that's the difference.
I just always think about how when we're going through anything, especially if it's an emotional breakdown or we just have that moment and the person next to you breaks out the tissue, like, okay, fix your face, you know, get mm-hmm. stuff together, come on back in. No, like,
exactly.
Do what you gotta do to get yourself together. And then, you know, these sessions, or when we work with girls, it feels therapeutic, but it should not be our therapy session.
Exactly.
That's why I love this book. I mean, first of all, let's just make sure that people understand how significant Project Butterfly was. The entire book, the programming that you had, that was and has been the inspiration, and I believe, like, the model for so many who are working with our girls in our communities. And it's been, you were groundbreaking in that before that book, not a lot is being an overstatement. There was literally almost nothing that dealt with exactly how to do rites of passage and the healing work of our girls. And you talk about, in both of these, the souls of our girls. First of all, I want you to clarify what you mean by souls and also what you mean by our girls, if you could give that clarification.
Absolutely. And you know, clarifying that, you know, the whole piece of souls, you know, when I wrote Project Butterfly, the first thing that some people will say, well, is it, you know, is it Christian or is it, you know, it's not a religious book at all. And there is a definite distinction between religion and spirituality. And spirituality to me is the part of us that is our divine self. It is the part of us that is God. and is connected to God, because God is, we are. And so we are like small little containers of that God essence. And so understanding that we are all connected, and that there is so, you know, we're physical beings in these, we are spiritual beings in these physical bodies. And our body is like our mobile home that we get to use and ride around in as we do our mission and our purpose. You know, so when I wrote Project Butterfly, what I saw was that was what was missing, that we were telling our girls to have self-esteem and to have, you know, you need to have more self-respect and, you know, all of these things, you know, looking at all of the errors of their ways and things that they were doing that weren't honoring to themselves. But I didn't hear a lot of people telling them that, you know, you're looking for love, but you are love. That is the essence of who you are. And so Project Butterfly was based on that premise, and I wanted to expound on it in every aspect of life to make it clear. And I'm a visual person, so I, you know, when I think and when I hear, I think in pictures. So it was very easy to draw examples and analogies and those kinds of things to make that concept real. And less, you know, just something that's way out there that doesn't have anything to do with me. And so when I started writing Project Butterfly, I wanted to make it accessible to girls in a way that was specific to them, and that they could connect themselves back to the Creator. You can call God, Jehovah, whatever name you call it, to just be connected. And so, you know, without trying to dictate what that looks like, just focusing on the fact that that's the essence of it. Because if you don't have a purpose, if you don't have a connection, then none of this makes sense. This whole life existence makes no sense at all. But if you can get back to the essence of why you're here and understanding that purpose, then it makes it all worthwhile. And so that's why, for me, it's soul work. It is not. It has nothing to do with this physical existence at all. It's about the soul, because that's where your joy, that's where your love, that's where the essence of who you are. That's the essence of all of that, and everything else is just a reaction to that. So when I wrote Inspiring the Souls of Our Girls, at first, just to be completely transparent about this, when I first started thinking about writing the second book, the original title was Searching for the Souls of Our Girls. And I played with that for a long time. And then as the book started coming forth, I realized, well, nobody's searching for their souls. They're in there. We just need to have, you know, help them to be inspired. And so once I received that title, it kind of helped to flow the book in a whole different way. Of not from a deficit base, but from an asset-based model, so to speak. So looking at the fact that our girls, yes, they can act trifling, they can act all of these different ways as any human being can, but the fact that the more we remind them of who they are, that they are more than just a collection of body parts. You know, when you ask a girl, you know, who she is, and she tells you, you know, she's, you know, describing herself, she's describing all of her physical features, you know, the size of her butt and the length of her hair and the hue of her skin. And that's just your mobile home. It's just like you describing your car, your vehicle. But that's not the essence of who you are. And, you know, and a deeper space, who's in the car, who's in the vehicle. And so helping them to really focus on that rather than all of the external things, because that's where the balance is. You know, you can have it, you can look wonderful on the outside, but if you don't have nothing going on the inside, it's a waste. You know, it's a waste of beauty, it's a waste of all of that. And, you know, but if there's a balance of inner beauty and outer beauty, then that's a wonderful thing. That's inspiring, you know, because when you see someone that's got it all together on the inside and the outside, it inspires you. to want to do that as well. And so just wanting to support girls and women who support girls so that we can get that balance. Because, you know, black women, African women of African descent, it is, you know, no question, we are beautiful. We've got that external beauty down.
I love that you talk specifically those words, like that those words that are beautiful, that evoke inspiration, that evoke creativity, that evoke a higher power. In fact, in the book you say, speaking about girls and their souls, you say, when we allow the light of our soul to shine through, it is impossible for others to ignore it. There's a radiance that shines through, a brightness that shines through our eyes and creates a magnificent glow. Unfortunately, many of our girls walk around with their inner light on dim, mostly because no one has taught them that their internal light switch is in their control.
Absolutely, absolutely. And a lot of what happens is the things that happen to us, we interpret that that's who we are. So if we grow up in an unloving families or families that don't give us all that we think that we need, then we start believing that we are less than. We start believing, and then, you know, you just look at society, and, you know, we are certainly not in a culturally equal society. So, you know, there are definitely some disparity there that's constantly trying to tell you that you're not good enough and that there is not enough and that, you know, you're less than. And so our girls sometimes walk around and come into the world thinking that there is something wrong. You know, the first thing that, you know, when a little baby, you know, in our, you know, culture will say, you know, what, you know, what's, you know, describe the baby, oh, he's light-skinned, or he's dark-skinned, or, you know, the baby, oh, that's some good hair now, that baby, you know, that hair's gonna turn, I hope that baby's hair don't turn. And, you know, we always are talking about fixing, you know, I gotta fix your hair, I gotta fix this. Okay. And so we come in, those subtle things, words have power, words have tremendous power, you know, and so we're constantly hearing things, even on the subtle level and stuff that we have now taken as just, you know, we take it for granted. But things are said in ways that are always negative. And so part of that is retraining our minds that, you know, and putting those positive things in. Not to say that, you know, that they aren't, you know, they're not true and we're just trying to, you know, just say some nice-sounding things, but they're things that are true. We are magnificent. We are beautiful. We are enough. We are loved. You know, it's like, you know, understanding that and really living through it. And so when I say that in the book, and every time women read the book, it's like, wow, this is truth. This is, you know, this is exactly the way I want to live. And how, you know, but I'm not congruent. You know, the things that I want to do, you know, I can't seem to live up to that. I still get angry. I still overreact. I still, you know, sabotage myself. And part of the reason for that is that we're not doing our work. You know, you cannot give what you don't have. You know, you can wish that our girls are healthy and whole, but if you're not healthy and whole, you can't support that. You know, I was a flight attendant for 8 years with American, and, you know, one of the biggest lessons that I've learned and that has stuck with me throughout all these years was those safety drills. And we would do these safety drills every month, you know, to practice in case of an emergency, what would you do? And one of the drills was, you know, about the oxygen mask. If the plane lost altitude, you know, there's specific things that the flight attendants were supposed to do in order to make sure that all of the passengers were safe. And I remember one flight in the 8 years that I flew, those little orange masks that mm-hmm. fall from the right above the seat,
mm-hmm.
the oxygen mask. In all of my years of flying, they only came down one time. And, you know, 8 years of doing drills every month, you know, that's a lot of practice for one time, one-time emergency. But I remember that that incident, and it's been kind of embedded in my mind. And every time I forget about balance, I think about that incident. We were on a flight. I can't tell you where we were going, but it was back when, you know, we did, you know, the full food service and all of that. But I was on the beverage cart, and there was a woman, and she had her, it was a full flight. So there were three people in the row, and she had a two-year-old with her. And so they were sitting just normal flight, and out of nowhere, the oxygen mask, we lost altitude, and the oxygen mask came down. And so in that split second, we were, you know, continuing to descend. And so the captain came on and, you know, reinforced for everybody to put their oxygen mask on. And I was maybe five rows in front of this woman, so I couldn't get to her at the time. But instead of putting her oxygen mask on, which we tell you in the drill, so always put your oxygen mask on first before you assist a child or anybody else that needs support. She was attempting, just mother instinct, to put the mask on her two-year-old. Well, you know, we were losing altitude at a rapid rate, so the oxygen was, you know, it was changing. The oxygen levels within the plane was changing. And so she was, you know, struggling. Just in those few minutes, she was struggling, and she couldn't. Her eyes were starting to glass over, and she just could not comprehend how to get this mask on the baby in a proper way. Well, thankfully, I was able to get to her and get her oxygen mask on, and then she was able to support the child appropriately. But seeing that visual and actually experiencing it, I've never forgotten it in all of these years, because it was a real visual for me of what it is if you don't take care of yourself. No matter how much she wanted and loved that child, she couldn't give her what she didn't have. She didn't have oxygen. So it was impossible for her to make sure that her child had the proper amount of oxygen. And so I've never forgotten that, and it just has always been embedded in me to make sure that I take care of myself before I try to take care of others. And I've had many reminders after that, you know, situations where I've had to, you know, wanted to give something that I didn't have. And that's part of that again, that training, that superwoman training, to never say no, to be a pleaser, to not want to disappoint anybody. And as women, we do that all the time.
Absolutely.
You know, we do that all the time. We're trained to take care of everybody's needs except for our own. And we, you know, we almost wear it as a badge of honor. I didn't eat so my kids could eat. And, you know, I didn't, you know, I haven't had no new shoes in 15, 20 years so my kids could have, you know. And that's great. There is some admirable qualities about that. But the balance of that is that what kind of message are you sending to your girl children? You're telling them that they come, you know, they should be last. And so then the other part of that is, well, I don't want to be selfish. Well, there's a difference between selfish and self-full. When you are full, then you can give out of that abundance and not out of the deficit, you know. So
this is why I love this book, because it is, I mean, it's so many things, but it's the oxygen mask for
yes.
those who want to work with Urban Girls. It's the oxygen mask for you to pass on and to put over the, to make sure that young girls get it, our girls get it. It's just so necessary, because the way you break things down in the book about the self-care that's necessary for an adult advocate, but also how we can realize who our girls are, to even recognize that, you know, you, even if you did have the oxygen, your oxygen is not enough for them. You know what I mean?
Right.
The way you make it, and, you know, even when you get yourself together, you still have to see them for their needs. They're separate and apart from who we are, even though they are us. They're separate
right.
and apart. So I want to go into several things. One, first is the different representatives. You say VIP, representative, and Mirror Me. I want you to talk a little bit about that, but then I also want to talk about how, again, let's just clarify, our girls I don't want to put the words in your mouth. Do you tell me what you mean by our girls?
Well, when I say our girls, I am unapologetically, I'm of African descent, you know, and I believe that, you know, we all are of African descent, if truth be told, because that was where, you know, we originated, was in Africa, you know, humankind. So when I say our girls, I'm talking about, you know, I speak from a very specific cultural experience inspiring the souls of our girls, that unapologetically I'm not speaking from a Eurocentric voice, I'm speaking from an African-centered voice. And our girls are all of the girls that we embrace from that platform, from that, you know, distinction. And so our girls are all girls, but unapologetically they are our girls that are culturally of African descent. So I give a lot of examples from that voice. And unapologetically, because there are so many books out there that we can glean, that we read from and we glean all kinds of information from that speak from a European voice. They don't have to necessarily say this is from white people and this is from that cultural expression. But we get it. We get it because of the examples that are used and just the cultural expression that it's written from. And, you know, from a collective place, you know, this book is written from an African centered perspective. And so
I want to just take the time to acknowledge you for that and to really say that you have provided, this is just it's a gift, because it's nothing like seeing yourself as a footnote or as a chapter or a paragraph in something. Nothing makes you feel more other than that.
Right.
Than when you're learning about something and you're just a footnote, or you just have a small paragraph or a small chapter devoted to your needs specifically. And so for that, Sister Niambi, this book, you are a gift because of that approach, because of that unapologetic approach.
Well, give thanks. That's the only way that I can write and be authentic is out of my own experience and my love for, you know, our people. And part of that is that, you know, there people think that, well, if you love, you know, black folks and, you know, you hate white folks, I don't hate anybody. I don't have to hate anybody to love my people and to love myself and to love my culture and to be able to express out of that, to be able to write out of that, to be able to think out of that expression. So it's unapologetically. I don't have to explain or apologize or validate the fact that we are hurting because of the experiences that have happened in this country. You know, we still haven't healed over our, you know, collective wounds. You know, in the book, I call it the still in trauma syndrome, because it's not post-slavery. We're still stuck there in many ways. And so for us to pretend like that doesn't affect us, our self-esteem, it doesn't, that we're in a society that still treats us as if we are not enough and reinforces that belief. How can I not write out of that expression, you know, and be authentic?
And be authentic, and it's when you say that, it's also when you look at how we are being erased, symbolically erased, and also systematically how everything is. I want us to work with our girls. I want those of us who work with our girls to have this book. Everybody should go and get this book, and we're going to tell you how you can get this book from Sister Niambi and Project Butterfly and the Butterfly Movement. But I want, even if you are not of African descent, you have worked with girls who are of African descent, or you have a population of girls who, you know, who you serve, you need to have this book, because there's just a different cultural relevancy and a different cultural approach that you have to be familiar with. you have to care about and be concerned about. I don't know, Sister Naomi, and this is not in the book, but I don't know if you've been in tune with something that's happened in pop culture with two rappers. One is Azalea Banks. Azalea Banks, and she's a sister.
Okay.
She's from Harlem. She's a young sister. She's about 22, 23. I'm not sure, you know, if I'm getting the age right or wrong. And then there's Iggy Azalea, who is from Australia. She's from a completely appropriated culture. And she has been named the number one female rap artist, hip-hop rap artist. And, of course, those of us who have come from what created hip-hop know that that is absolute appropriation, that it is completely out of bounds.
Right.
And so this young sister, I'm going to send you this just so you can see it. This young sister has been, as they say, beefing with this whole perception and just acceptance of her at the erasure and discredit, you know, just invalidation of other sisters who have been in it and who have created it and who come from it, and how they've just been completely erased or pushed aside or, you know, just not validated or honored. And so this sister, Azalea Banks, was given an interview, and she literally wept so much anger in talking about how she felt that even what's ours, what's created for us and by us, to help us heal and deal with what we have to, you know, deal with through being in this country, how that just takes her whole life. It feels like the life is being sucked out of her. She used a word, I can't think of the word that she used, but she used a word that was so powerful. It was smudging us out. That's the word she said. And so when you say that you are writing this specifically for our girls, they so need it. And I want to talk to you about when you talk about the VIP, because when I watched this girl, Azalea Banks, I watched her interview. I saw her representative there. And you talk about that. I saw all of this stuff, this hard stuff. Like, I don't care. I mean, she uses a lot of profanity, so I don't give a F. You know, about that girl. I don't give a F about what's going on. This is what it is, and I'm me, and I'm real. You know, she had this whole bravado thing going. Well, she broke down in those tears. You knew that the true self of her was coming through. So if you can talk about the VIP and the representative and the mirror me, that would be very insightful for so many who are listening.
Oh, well, just thanks. Well, you said a lot and so many things that I want to address. Part of why we're so angry when people, when we feel that we have been discounted and smudged out is because, again, we're from, you know, hurt people never, you know, to fight anger and hatred with hatred, it never works. It doesn't, you know, a negative and a negative, it doesn't create that positive. It doesn't work like that. And so part of our healing has to happen where we have to stop looking for others to validate us. We have to stop looking for those that have created the pain to somehow, you know, we're still waiting for that, you know, that I'm sorry. We're still waiting for that validation. And while we're waiting, we're still hurting and hurting each other and still crying out for that we're probably not going to get. You know, frankly. So if we turn our attention back to ourselves and empower ourselves, then we would have a different experience. And that's the piece that we have to heal, but we can't keep doing the same things over and over expecting a different result, especially when we're expecting the culture that created the pain and still benefits from our pain, you know, to somehow find the error of their ways and their what's called a come to Jesus moment, and then we all, you know, back in alignment with each other. That may happen at some point, but we can't wait for that to happen. Meanwhile, we're angry, we're hurting each other, we're going through all of these things. So in the book, I tried to explain in a different way the what we feel or what we experience when we, as a spiritual being, how do we express those different parts of ourselves that are not congruent? You know, we've got our, you know, like you said in Azalea's interview, there was a part of her that was just hard and, you know, I don't care, you know, just the bravado piece that was definitely, you know, disconnected from, you know, I don't care about what she thinks or I don't care about what's going on. And, you know, it's about me. And then there's a part of her that was more tender and just more authentic, and that I'm really hurting about this, that it's not really about Azalea or about Iggy. What it's really about is that I feel disrespected. I feel slighted. I feel like I'm not being heard. So that's a different perspective than, you know, saying that I don't feel like I'm being heard versus I don't care about what she's doing. It don't matter what, you know, she ain't, you know, so it's not congruent. So there's different aspects of us. And I've tried to explain it in a way that, you know, it's the same thing about our ego, you know, but just named it differently and attributed some aspects to it that hopefully people can make it more user-friendly. And so the VIP, and I call it, you know, there's a saying that when two people meet, there's actually six people. There's the person that they think they are, there's the person that you think that I am, and then there's the person that I really am. And so in that, I think there's a part of us that is our divine self. There's the part of us that is connected to God, that is God. Every time we take a breath, it is a reminder and an affirmation that we are connected to God, that there's nothing that we can do to earn our breathing or earn anything. It just is. Every time you wake up in the morning, you don't have to, you know, unless you've got some health challenges, you don't have to do anything to activate the breath and to activate your being here. That's that part of us that is God. There's a part of us that is so connected, that knows our purpose and our mission in life and wants to do good. And everybody has that aspect within themselves. Everybody that's human, we have that. And I've named it the VIP. It's the part of us that is the most important part. And then there's a part of us that, you know, every VIP has a representative. Or, you know, if you're really important, you've got your entourage, you've got some your bodyguard. You know, have you ever tried to get to an important person, even in corporate world? They have, you know, their secretary, and so that secretary or assistant will decide whether you're important enough to actually meet the VIP. You don't just walk in on somebody that's really important. And so it's the same thing with us as human beings. We all have our internal representative. We have our own internal, just to kind of demonstrate that, have you ever heard of somebody who is talking about themselves, but they're talking in third person? Oh, she doesn't do that. Oh, no, she doesn't do that. Or they'll even say, oh, Miss So-and-so does not do that. And they're talking about themselves, you know? And so that's the part, that's our representative. That's the part of us that is built in to protect us from every hurt, from being hurt, from hurting anybody. It's the part, it's our bodyguard, so to speak. It's our representative. It's the part of us that can say, I don't care about nothing, you know. But it's set and designed to protect us, you know, from all the other representatives that are out there. From everybody else that also, everybody has a representative. Everybody has that aspect. And so that aspect is built out of our pain, not out of our power. It's the part of us that believes that we are all separate from each other. And because we believe that, it creates all of this dis-ease, all of this disharmony, all of this misappropriation, you know, from each other. It creates all of these wounds. And so then there's the part of us, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Even in the book with the representative, you give examples about how our girls kind of manifest at their representative, how we can see it. And so you say they use their representative, well, we all do, but we're speaking specifically about our girls, use it as a mask to mask how they really feel and to protect themselves emotionally, physically, and spiritually. And you talk about that tough girl act, too.
Absolutely. It's in a day and culture where, you know, it used to be if somebody called you a female dog, you know, that would be fighting words. Now it's, you know, that's my B, that's my, you know, so it's that, you know, that is no longer the word that will get you fighting. But it's really interesting that now, in order to really insult a girl or anybody, the word that you need to call is just call them a punk. I ain't no punk. And so now you've got to defend and fight because somebody thinks you weak. And so it makes sense that our representative, of course, the worst thing that you could call a bodyguard is a punk or weak, because that's job security. You don't want nobody to think that you're weak. And so for girls, that they have that tough girl exterior presence that, you know, you look at our schools now and they're more, the girls are more aggressive now than the boys. And not just aggressive of, you know, boys, yes, some of them are aggressive because of testosterone and all of that other than just being boys and roughhousing with each other. But now girls, the level of fighting has become more vicious, and just at the drop of a hat. I've been in schools where, you know, all girls are fighting. You know, you do a group of girls and take a poll, how many of y'all fight, and everybody raises their hand. And, you know, asking, I even say it in the, you know, book, you know, I was sitting with a group of girls and, you know, 14, 15-year-olds, and asking them, you know, how many of you fight? And they all raising their hands. And, well, why do you fight? Well, because she thinks she's better than me. And she, you know, she says she want to fight me, so I'm, you know, I got to shut her down. She messing with my man. And, you know, all of these things that, you know, make you think you're sitting in a prison yard because of the way that, you know, it's more important to defend about we don't want to be punked. You know, I don't want to show that weakness. I don't want to be vulnerable because I've got to protect myself because I'm not safe. And that's the message, is I'm not safe. Now, in Chicago and Ferguson and all of these other cities across, our fear is not just paranoia. You know, we are definitely in an unsafe society that things can happen. But that's not all that happens, that we are, if you're walking around always on guard, always in a point where you can't be authentic, you're ready, you're either in offense mode or defense mode, then you're either ready for a fight or defending the fight, you know, and that's the posture that the representative is always in. It's always in defense, always ready to defend my position on something. And so how can you heal and how can you actually be in relationship if you're always in one of those two modes? So there's a third aspect of us, which is the mirror me, and that's the part of us.
Listen to me, Abby, before you do that, let me go back to that, because I want to ask you, do you think that is, I know it's not germane to us, I know it's not just only us, but do you think that is more so girls who are in urban areas, our girls who are growing up in, you know, the constant the communities of violence and poverty, do you think that they have to feel like they're on guard, you know, that they have that fight or flight always there? Is that more, do you think that that's more common?
If you're asking about the representative and how it shows up, I think we all, first of all, have a representative, and how it shows up, I think theirs is just overworked. You know, when you're in urban situations where the danger is real, but then there are perceived dangers. So you're always ready for danger even when there isn't danger. You know, you already, you know, you got your weapon drawn, and ready to be provoked. And the other piece is that there are a lot of times, again, drilling it back to our first example of Auntie Wanda that, you know, had some hurt, some previous hurt that just showed up in that experience. Our girls have that as well. You know, have situations. I think in one of the first chapters of the book, I talk about a young woman who was being molested at home, and because she wasn't safe at home and had so much anger, she took that anger. She couldn't fight off her attacker and her abuser, so she brought that anger to school and fought girls, a way to alleviate some of that stress and that anger. So it's, you know, we're all like walking time bombs, that we don't have to always be in dangerous situations, but we're eating that all the time. We're eating that fear all the time. We watch the news and what's happening, what happens in St. Louis or Chicago or any of our major cities. We're constantly digesting fear and why we should be afraid and why we should have our weapons drawn, our emotional weapons drawn, so that we are never in a space of safety. And so for our girls, it plays out because, you know, I remember when I was, you know, 13 and 12 and 14 and all of that, fighting was rare. You know, there were girls that fought, but it wasn't the first thing that you did. If somebody offended you, you just didn't go to blows as the first response. And now it has become so commonplace that we don't even think about it. It's mirrored in on television in these reality shows. The first thing that you see grown women, you know, how do they resolve conflict? You know, go to blows, you know, fight, or just, you know, throw over tables, or, you know, disrespect each other verbally, you know. And that's the other piece. It doesn't have to be physical fight, but we are constantly, you know, berating each other verbally. So it's all kinds of ways to defend the self and defend your position and defend. And when you're constantly in defense, then you cut down the possibility and the option that maybe there's another way to look at this. Maybe there's some other information that I don't have. Maybe this person isn't really out to get me. Maybe they're operating out of their pain too, and this doesn't have anything to do with me. I don't want to digress or take us off into something else,
but that is absolutely, just listening to that and knowing what it is and seeing it and being familiar with it, it is absolutely not healthy. And so I love how you break it down, because that helps us to realize we need to move into another space, you know, clinically, with our girls, to provide them what they need health-wise. Because to have that much stress, that much cortisol, that's setting us up for the cancers later in life, you know?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we see it. We see it happening all the time, that there's so many women that have cancers and fibroids and all kinds of things, just dis-ease in the body, period. But there's a third aspect that I want to, you know, I've given you the two, the VIP and the representative, and I just want to briefly, just for balance, give that third piece, and that's the mirror me. That's the part of us that exists as a reflection. It's almost as if our representative self has on some of those dark reflective glasses. So what you see when you look in it is actually a mirror reflection of the self, and that's the hardest aspect for us to really digest, because when we see injustice and when we see, you know, it's like, man, you know, it's that can't be about me. That person has a problem. That person has a problem, yes. But you can only see that problem if you also have that problem, you know, if it's also in you. So when girls say, you know, I can't stand her, she thinks she all that. Well, does she really think she all that, or do you think she's all that? You know, is what you see in her just reminding you that maybe I haven't grown that aspect in me? For instance, I'll use something very generic just to prove the point. Like, if you're always upset about somebody being late, you know, this person, I can't stand them because they always late. They just, you know, disrespectful of my time, and I would never, you know. And then you go on into this whole judgment about, you know, why, you know, you don't like anybody that's late or whatever. And then what you realize, you know, if you're honest with yourself, you don't like that aspect of, you don't like that quality of being late. But and the truth is, you're late too. But you don't like that. You don't tolerate that within yourself. So you certainly aren't going to tolerate that quality in somebody else. If I don't like that within me, I'm certainly not going to like that when I see it in you. So that person is just reflecting, is a reflection of us. And we can own, if we can own that. Now, that's a hard pill to digest. That's a hard one to digest because it's very easy to constantly point out that so, you know, everybody is causing us pain. Mm-hmm. When in reality, if you spot it, you got it. If you see something in somebody, there is no human quality. There's no condition in the human experience that is foreign to anybody. You know, when I see all kinds of injustices, if I get fearful enough, I will probably be acting out the same way. If I'm in fear. So everybody becomes our teacher, not to justify it, not to say that it's right or anything like that, but just know that if we all took responsibility for ourselves, then that's the answer to everything. So part of what the book and trying to help women to understand is that, you know, when we, you know, we say we want to help our girls, the best way is to inspire them by taking care of yourself, modeling that. Everything you see in girls is probably in you. You know, when I sat down with women, and, you know, usually the conversation will always get around girls. And, ooh, how fast these girls are. These girls are trifling. And they ain't got no respect for their bodies. They ain't got no respect. And it's usually the ones that are the most critical, honestly. Are the ones that have shady past themselves.
Say
the one
that,
that's sitting
say
in
that. Say that. Yes. Yes.
The
and
ones that
the
have
truth.
A dysfunctional relationship. The
yes.
ones that are sitting there, you know, with inappropriately dressed or doing things, and but yet they can see it in girls because they know within themselves that they're not fully honoring themselves. So I don't like it in me, so I can't stand it
mm-hmm.
in you.
Or they're not even fully, they're not half dressed. They're fully dressed. They got the turtleneck. You can't see an inch of their body.
Right.
However,
exactly.
If you rewind it back to 15, 25, 30 years ago, you'd see them in the same way. So, yes.
Exactly.
Yes.
Exactly. So it becomes, and our girls see how hypocritical we are, that we tell them one thing a lot of times, and yet we do something different. We act differently. And I'm not saying that I am perfect in any of this, but what I have learned is that I got to worry about myself, and I got to put my oxygen mask on, and I have to daily examine to make sure that I am reflecting what I want to see in the world, that there's enough pain and hurt and all of that, and I don't want to add to that because there's either, you know, one of two ways to be. There's either you're either in love or you're in fear. You know, we always think that, we say that the opposite of love is hate, but it's not. Hate is a reaction. Hate is the opposite of joy, you know. But love and fear are, if you're either in love, and any time that you're moving out of a space of love, you're in fear. You're believing that there is either not enough or not adequate or there's something that you're not going to get. And you're angry because you're not getting it, or you're scared or afraid of something. So we either in love or in fear. A lot of what the racial stuff that we see happening today is because of fear. It has absolutely nothing to do with who we are, but we take that on as if, you know, somebody else's hatred has anything to do with us, and it doesn't. There's an African saying that don't let what somebody else eat make you sick.
Oh,
and that's
wow.
The truth. Don't let what somebody else make you sick. That has absolutely nothing to do with you. But yes, we should. I'm so not saying, please hear me, that I'm not saying that we should advocate against injustices, you know, and oppression and all of those things. But there's also a bigger picture.
You're saying that
I'm not saying that we should not do those things.
Okay.
We should march. We should do whatever it takes to show that, you know, to spread light on us, on any injustice.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't get stuck and believe that what somebody else is doing is any reflection on us. That's part of why we are stuck in this paradigm of thinking that we are not enough. Because we're taking somebody else's pain and, you know, and taking it on. You know, a lot of what it's, well, see, I haven't gone from preaching to meddling now, so.
This is what it's about, and this is the role that we have to do to inspire our girls. It takes all that, the teacher, the preacher, the meddler, it takes all of that. And so, and so in the book, you even go into that, and I want to talk about, well, I just want to set this up for everybody who's listening, those who are of African descent and those who are serving our girls. This next piece, well, the whole book you have to have, but this next piece is why it's so important for your project, for Project Butterfly and for the Butterfly Movement. This is why it's so important for this type of programming to be in schools and to be provided in spaces where girls are, because you have to be familiar. You have to hold the space. If you don't have the tools to do it, you have to have your organization come in, my organization come in, any organization that is fully, you know, on the foundation of dealing with our girls. You have to have it in there, because you can't make it a side note. You can't make it a footnote. And so the next thing I want to talk about is the African Butterfly Family.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
This is so important. And rites of passage itself is so important. So if you, I'll just give you the floor to just take it wherever you want to take it with that.
Well, I think, and thank you for that, because, you know, when we talk about African descent and we talk about our girls and all of that, it's from a space of understanding culturally who we are. You know, every culture on the planet, every people's get, you know, takes very much pride, a lot of pride in who they descend from. My ancestors are from, you know, Europe, or, you know, Italian, or, you know, Native American, or whatever it might be. And we operate from that root. It's like a plant, you know, when you've got strong roots, then you're strong, you're unmovable. You can bend, but you won't break when you've got strong roots, and understanding that. And so that's why, for me, there is no culture to black and white other than this culture. There is no root. It's not, you can't show me a place on the planet other than, you know, where that is actually rooted. And most indigenous, there's not an indigenous group that does not have a relationship with the Creator. And so that's what gets us back to our soul, is by connecting back to the root, because that's our foundation. So when we sit in this African American black culture and we have no root, that's why we get, you know, we crazy, because there's nothing for us to anchor us. There is no connection that really binds us to this earth, and thus binds us to the Creator. And so from the very beginning, I knew that that if I was creating anything, it had to be created out of that foundation. That so when we did camp, we started, and even Project Butterfly, I knew that we had to create that connection the same way that our ancestors did with each other. That family was, we're all connected, and we all have inner connectedness and responsibility for and to each other. And so the girls immediately, I mean, we set up that, you know, adults were mamas and aunties, and not just from a, you know, that's a wonderful title, but there's a responsibility. There's a role that you play, you know, when you are, you know, within my organization, a mama and the auntie. And so that sounds great, but there's also responsibility to that, that I have a responsibility to nurture girls and a responsibility to my community and that family to make sure that I am expressing beyond just my needs. So a mama, you know, you think of a mama's role within the family, that's a powerful place. Mama's a nurturer. Mama is kind of the, if mama ain't happy, nobody's happy, because mama takes, you know, as a mother, you know that role. So just understanding what that means and what that engenders within the community is important. So we take those roles. And then there are aunties. So women take on the role of aunties, and aunties is a little different than mamas. And the definitions, of course, go deeper, but I'm just kind of giving you an overall view.
And you,
that they,
and you, have,
you, know.
You have them in the book, so anybody who
yeah.
wants to
so there's aunties.
They can get in the book.
And the girls come in as cousins, you know, that they are connected to each other. And, you know, in all of the years of doing Camp Butterfly, we have never had any kind of physical altercation between girls. And it's a beautiful thing, because setting that foundation, we've never had to break up fights. We never had to had any kind of physical altercation. It's like, this is your cousin from Ohio. Get to know her. You know, and so girls come in with that frame of mind that this is family. This is, there's a safety around it, that we are, you know, I used to call Camp Butterfly as like a big family reunion, because we're all very different. And we come in not expecting to be the same, but we all have a core belief that we are connected. And out of that connection, we respect each other. That we know that because of that belief, we are invested in each other. You know, and so it all rests on the principles of Kwanzaa, that there is a collective responsibility. There is an accountability. And if we don't have accountability, and that's the piece that our African-centeredness gives us, is accountability, connection, that I understand, I am because you are, therefore I am. So because of that connection, when I hurt me, I'm hurting you. And I understand that we are not separate beings, that we are connected to the same source. So there is no us and them, there is we. And so if we came from that perspective, and that's why I reinforce that, that's the foundation for this, is that collectiveness.
I was going to tell you, I just love how you put it in the book when you say that is why in an African context, the concept of kinship describes not only the biological ties, but the sociological bonds as well.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And so when we understand that, then we know that we are responsible, that our actions affect everybody. So that's why for women that we have, you don't get whole just for your own glorification. You get whole for the community, because there are girls that are watching you and dependent on you. So to say we need to do our work is not just so that, you know, you can do your work. It's because we are all interdependent on you to do your work. Mm-hmm. When you don't do your work, you hurt everybody. You show up in a way that's not clean. You show up in a way that's not congruent. It breaks down communication, because I'm either defending against or fighting with your representative, you know. And my representative is gonna, you know, my people will feed your people, and so we, you know, we're in this defensive battle. Or we can show up and know that any offense that happens. That, let me get more information. Let me see it from a different perspective. Let me see how I participated in that. You know, we always say we should take responsibility for our actions. And what does that really mean? It just means to be able to respond with ability. And so how do you respond with ability? You have to have ability. You have to know that, you know, everything that happens, we help co-create. And so if we are partly responsible, if we're feeding more of the negative or if we're feeding more of the positive, You know, yes, they're in this culture for real. There's some crazy dark energy. And we can continue to feed that dark energy, or we can start bringing some light and letting our light, you know, that old Negro spiritual, this little light of mine, I'm going to let it shine. Our ancestors understood that. That wasn't just, they understood that that light within us, even in the darkest of situations, that, you know, that what was happening, even when they were enslaved, said more about those that were enslaving them. They knew that it had nothing to do with them and who they were and their value.
That's deep.
You know, they understood that. And so they were able to keep the sense of who they were, and to operate out of that light spirit. And even to not have the darkness to reside in their hearts, and to be able to nurture and help and support even in the midst of all of that. And for us, sometimes we think that we equate kindness with weakness. And that's our representative. You know, we want everybody to pay for everything that's happened. Sometimes we just got to take care of ourselves.
And this, I love the, we're going to close out with the 10 ways to transform, 10 ways to effectively support teenage girls. But before we get to that, I want to talk about, again, moving from the foundation of the foundation of family and making sure that's understood, and at the precipice of working with girls, but then to also talk about this, I think is very powerful, the searching for a chrysalis, yearning for a rites of passage, and how important this is for our girls, and how we can get this back into not just a program, but how we can just make it a normal part of curriculum, a normal part of any space that girls are, you know, that serve girls, that is a part of it, that this is a part of what should happen. So talk about how important that is. And then also, and this goes back to pop culture. I don't know if you've heard about the sorority sisters.
Yeah.
Show that's been boycotted, and it's a big thing about it. But if you can talk about the rites of passage, and then we can move into that conversation that you have in the book about that as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you know, again, speaking from an African-centered space, and why, you know, our ancestors, they understood that, you know, there is a natural delineation of, you know, when you move from girlhood into womanhood, and there was a celebration around that, you know, usually around our menstrual cycles, where we would, you know, kind of be initiated into that the womanhood club, so to speak. So letting, you know, shedding our girl voice and behavior and all of that, and to become really ushered into becoming a woman. And in our society today, we don't have that. You know, the only kinds of adult rituals we have, you know, when you turn 21, you can now, you know, go get drunk and also get tried as an adult. You know. But the other thing is that, you know, we look at it like for graduation, prom, and, you know, that becomes kind of like our, what used to be like the cotillion and that kind of thing, kind of that celebration of a girl becoming a woman. It's now translated over into prom. So women spend all of this, you know, families spend all of this money on a girl's prom dress and hair, and, you know, some of these proms. I was just at one this last year, and it was like I was going to the wedding, girl. It was just,
oh, yes.
All of this money was spent on the limousine, and her dress had to be at least almost $1,000, and her hair, and, you know, just all of that. But this one experience ushering her into what? You know, it was a wonderful celebration, but what information did she have that was going to usher her into her adulthood? And I think that's the piece that we're missing, that our girls, I've dealt with so many girls, just kind of switching gears just a little bit, who have, you know, become sexually active and, you know, gotten pregnant the very first time they had sex. And I started thinking about that. Why is that? It's because nobody has told her about what happens internally in her body, that her body is going to betray her, that certain times of the month, that you have a 30-day cycle, that, you know, certain, just like the moon, there are certain times of the month when you are going to be very vulnerable. Your body is ready and ripe to make a baby. So that could be, at certain times in the month, you don't want to have nothing to do with anybody.
Right.
You know, so you could, when you're pressed to have sex, you could say no. I ain't gonna do it. And then the next day, well, maybe, you know. Okay, well, maybe you can, you know, I'll let you touch it, but I ain't gonna let you do nothing else with it, you know. And then before you know it, you have gone all the way. And then, you know, why did I, you know, that's not what I wanted to have happen.
And then
but
sometimes
your body
can be aggressive, right? Even sometimes.
Right.
Absolutely,
because your body is wanting to make a baby. Your body is designed to do that. But if we don't give our girls that information, then how are we to be able to respond from that? We become almost a victim to our body, you know? And so that is just one aspect that of information that was given to girls during their rites of passage. And boys as well. Boys are missing out on rites of passage. Because even in that rites of passage, it showed them how to provide and protect and to be a man. And what did that mean? That you were the overseer of your family, and there were certain responsibilities and certain, skills that were given and shared with boys on how to hunt and how to take care of their family and how to provide. You know, so boys in this urban society, boys and girls, they miss out on that. So they turn 16 or you turn to adult, and we're still craving our rites of passage. So many of us, when we get into college, we turn to sororities, sisterhoods, brotherhoods, looking for that information. And we still don't get it on certain levels. So that's why you can see a show like Sorority Girls. It's a blatant show that obviously we didn't get it. Had nothing to do with sisterhood, because these women don't know how to treat each other.
Mm-hmm.
There's nothing about sister. They might as well just say sorority, because ain't no sisterhood on this at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's the piece that we and I'm grateful in a way for shows like this to show up, because again, it mirrors back to us what's going on in our communities and how do I show up. You know, in the world, do I have healthy relationships with other women? You know, so there's a lesson to be, you know, it's a big mirror, but if we look at it with a critical view of not just looking at the personality, but again, pointing that finger back to us and say, okay, I see, you know, the one character that I really don't like, and they are caricatures of each other, because that's just their representative, their caricature.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That caricature that rubs you the wrong way, you know, what part of her is really in me? And how can I change those aspects of me that show up and look just like that? And I don't like it in me, so I certainly don't like it in her. I don't like it, how it shows up, you know?
Mm-hmm.
That's how we do our work. That's how we do our work. So I'm grateful in a sense for that. Those are teachable moments.
Yeah.
You know, that show is a teachable moment. We can say, be very critical of them, but then use it for our girls to, okay, what is the real anchor of this? When you see these personalities on TV, they show you, give you enough information that to tell you that they're in pain. You know, so what is this? This is how pain shows up. If you don't take care of it, if you don't do your work.
And I don't want to get too deep into it, but I think that everything in this, the time right now, is a time for so much to come to the forefront, to force us to look at things, not just the sorority and sisterhood, but this whole reality phase, right? This whole phenomenal reality TV is a chance for us to really, because in order for us to get back to the love and stop operating out of the fear that you talk about, that love, the nurturing comes from where? Mostly from women. We are the ones who do it, but we're so out of whack and we're so out of alignment. We got to get back. And the only way is to say, like you said, to show it and mirror it so people can see what it is, what's out there, and help us to reflect, hopefully, some direct us
right.
back to some self-reflection.
And absolutely.
Being our 11 or 12 or 13-year-old self. We are past that. We're not 16 years old. We can't do high school over anymore. That's just fact. We can't do it over. But we
right.
can do the work that it takes. We can create our own rituals. We can do, you know, some of the spiritual work and some of the exercises and the gathering. We can even create our own sisterhood gatherings with other
mm-hmm.
women, but we can't do it in the spaces and the time that it's supposed to be about working with our girls. That's their time.
Absolutely. And this is a wonderful, I love how you just be all up in my head, because I was just getting ready to share exactly that about the, and what I'm really excited about is the butterfly movement. And it's speaking to all of that, because creating a space for women and girls to do our work. You know, a space for not only an expansion of Camp Butterfly, and what I'm really excited about is we piloted before the Caterpillar Camp, but this time we're going to do it a little bit differently. You know, in the past, I've taken girls away from their mother, and so really just creating these butterfly girls and sending them back into Caterpillar environments.
Mm.
And so now, looking at it and doing it in a different way, this summer we'll launch the Caterpillar Camp, and it will be a camp for little girls ages 3 to 10 and their mothers. And together, the mothers and the girls will be getting tools and just a celebration of self. It's going to be a fantastic camp. We'll launch it here in North Carolina first, and then we'll find other sites across the country to also do them. But the other piece that we'll also be launching in the spring is our Chrysalis Circle. And there'll be circles that virtual circles and also actual physical groups where women can come together and actually do their work in a very process-driven way that is just exciting. It's actually aligned with the chakras and just a dynamic curriculum that we've got aligned with that. I'm working with a sister in North that's currently residing in New Orleans, Sister Felicia Beckett. And she's actually helping with the creation and all of this of the butterfly movement. So it will be workshops, retreats, and, you know, even a sacred space for us to socially network online. So, you know, I'm really excited about that, because, you know, when you were saying we got to galvanize this in a whole different way, we are creating, you know, beyond a project now. Now we've moved on to a movement. So it is exciting stuff, because that's how we're going to change this paradigm, is by all of us. You know, we say do your work, but then how do you do your work? And where do you do your work? And what does that look like? And
what does it even
how
mean?
Do we create? I'm sorry, say that again.
I was just saying, what does it even mean?
Right.
Say do the work. Yeah.
What does that mean? What does that look like? And, you know, who do I, you know, where are safe spaces that we can do that? And how do we? And there's some talented sisters all across this country that are doing some very good work, that are helping to support women and girls. So we're galvanizing and connecting with and collaborating with and trying to shore up all of those programs that are working, because there are some, I mean, you do good work. There are some definitely some bright spots all across this country. But in order for us to have some some real sustainability and to have an even bigger impact, most of us need support. We need women who can support us. You know, I've seen a lot of programs that have these wonderful, charismatic, and dynamic sisters who then, you know, the program only lasts as long as they can do it because they can't duplicate themselves. You know, the women that show up aren't ready to, you know, they haven't done their work. So it's hard to expand a program beyond yourself. And so that's the part that I'm excited about, because that's the Butterfly Movement is about building capacity. It's about, you know, creating or helping to facilitate women so that then they can go out into the world and do their work and not only do their work, but then work in their passion and their vision. So it's about helping women to not necessarily to create Project Butterfly programs. We'll have that paradigm for you if that's what you want to do. If you want to create a Project Butterfly program in your community, the curriculum and all of that will be there. But if you just want to be able to do your own thing and create a dance program or create something else, how do you, because our issues show up no matter where we are. You know, we could have a wonderful program on knitting, and if we haven't done our work, guess what? We're going to still have to, you know, our problems are going to come with us. Our girls are going to still need, if they can't sit together, they're going to need facilitation. They're going to need support. So part of this is just, it's a part of who we are. It's not just something that we do. You know, so we have to do the work because it is who we are. We are spiritual beings. And so once we own that and live out of that experience rather than our representative. So in other words, you know, part of the Butterfly Movement will be helping us to live more out of our VIP than our representative, helping us to show up more in love than in fear. And how do we do that? Because we all want love. But if we all knew how to do love and to be love, you know, we would all have, there would be no problems. So there's an inconsistency, there's an incongruence that, you know, who I want to be, I can't always achieve. And I need support in getting to that I want to be. So stay tuned, girl, stay tuned.
Yeah, we are staying tuned. That's the gift, again, of you, Sister Niavi. I was going to say the gift of this book, but, I mean, this book is just one facet of your brilliance. And the gift of you is that I don't care what you're doing. My program in Atlanta, or program in Compton, California, no matter what we're doing, we need this, and we need you because, like you said, the components of working, the foundation of working with our girls, the rites of passage, we have to have, you know, it's like a language, right? Mm-hmm. So you have at your will all the words that are in a language. You can use them however you see fit. You can place them in sentence structures, paragraphs, but you have to have that language. And so I think that this is the language. What our girls need to know, the rites of passage, the understanding of self, we have to incorporate that into our programming. And I would love it. I know it's work that we have to do, but I would love it if we all could, in this movement, could come to the agreement that in our unique programming that we would use this as the foundation, as the model, so to speak, and the roadmap to get us there, because it gives us all the tools. And so as we wrap up, you have in this book so many tools. You have resources, even in terms of the rites of passage and the menstrual cycle and how girls can understand what's going on with their bodies. You have a book for that and a resource for that where you can find that online. Even in terms of getting to know the principles of Kwanzaa, you list those. So everything that we need to really know, as you said, our girls is in this book. And we'll close out with the 10 ways to effectively support teenage girls, which I think is just, oh boy, a gift. gift. And I use that word gift because it's something that, you know how they say gifts are something that should be personalized but still can be used time and this, you know, it's just, it's unforgettable and you can use it forever and ever and ever. And once you know these 10 ways to effectively support teenage girls, you've got it. And you can keep going back to it and revisiting it. It's so powerful. And so we'll close out with that. But I just want to say that this book is a must-have for anybody who is serving our girls, whether you have an organization or program or whether you're just an administrator at a school who wants to bring in some programming. If you're a Sunday school teacher, a youth minister, whatever it is that you're doing, if you have young girls in your presence, if you're a mother, or if you are a grandmother, or if you're a foster parent, if you have young girls in your midst, our girls in your midst, you absolutely must have Inspiring the Souls of Our Girls, 10 Ways to Effectively Support Teenage Girls, and you absolutely must connect with the Project Butterfly and the Butterfly Movement.
So how can women, if they want to be a part of this movement, how do they get involved?
We are going to launch our website mid-April, I think April 23rd of 2015. And the website is www.thebutterflymovement.com. And when we launch that it will be a national launch. So there will be ways that women can plug in across the country, and it will be a support primarily for women and girls. So there will be things, we will be doing our regular camp, but also Camp Butterfly will be there, but also there will be camps for women, resources, trainings, all kinds of just wonderful resources. Specifically, you know, in the beginning of this call, you were saying that there just wasn't a lot of resources out there. And so this movement will create a lot of resources, not just for myself, but there are so many other dynamic women that are out there that we don't know about that are kind of doing this work in a vacuum. So wanting to highlight that, just as your show is highlighting these resources, I want to also have kind of a network for that as well. So.
Well, we're inviting you in advance back onto Voices of Advocacy Radio to talk about that. In about 3 months, we'll have you back on to direct you to the website because it is absolutely necessary. And I think it is, I'm going to go ahead and say that it should be a prerequisite. I really think if people are doing this work, that we are human. And so all of us will constantly need support and resources and to go through our own process. It's a never-ending process. And so I think we should always be, you know, in that continuing education.
Absolutely.
Continuing education. And so I'm showing up for class. I'm your first student.
Well, give thanks.
Give thanks.
Well, it's a labor of love, honey, and if we can create more love and less fear, I'm all for it, and that's the piece, and that we have to stop being afraid of each other as women, and part of that is being able to have authentic relationships with each other.
Well, that's a word, and there's nothing else that needs to be said. Ladies and gentlemen, this is Niambi Jaha Eccles. Please pick up the book, Inspiring the Souls of Our Girls, 10 Ways to Effectively Support Teenage Girls. Look for the next movement that she's having come out, and we'll direct you to that website. Sister Niambi, is there a place now that they can go, either social networks or anything that they can go to now and get in touch with?
Yeah, right now, because we are Butterfly, so we are constantly in transformation, and my website is being redone right now, but I have a website specifically for the book. It's called www.inspiringgirls.weebly.com, and so that's just for the book, and you know, you can get you can purchase the book there, and by the spring I will have my other websites up as well.
Okay, we'll put a link out on our networks to back to the book's website so that people can go and get this, so that we in 2015 we can go into this year with a renewed sense of strength, a new renewed sense of resources and knowledge and wisdom, really, for our way forward in working with girls. Sister Niambi, you say give thanks all the time. We give thanks to you. We give thanks for your love, your spirit. We give thanks for your commitment and for your care. You know, you could just not care. You could have done what you did and kept going. And so we just thank you for having and saving a space for us. Thank you so much for being a guest on Voices of Advocacy Radio.
Thank you for having me during your inaugural. I am so honored. And I know
yes.
that the show will go on and support so many people. So I appreciate and thank you for your voice, because you're picking up the baton, girl. And I am so proud of you being in the field and on the front line. And so know that I see you.
Thank you, Sister Niambi.